Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, June 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Berkshire Plastic Surgeons in Great Barrington on Pittsfield, offering skin cancer screenings, Botox injections, fillers, cosmetic, and reconstructive surgery. BerkshirePlasticSurgeons.com. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. Rebecca Stetzer, a geriatrician from the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med. Dr. Stetzer takes a geriatric 5Ms approach to the evaluation and treatment of patients. We'll find out about that concept and get to your calls today as well. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Rebecca Stetzer on your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Dr. Rebecca Stetzer, a geriatrician with special interest in dementia care. Dr. Stetzer practices with the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med, a New York State designated center of excellence for Alzheimer's disease. She takes a geriatric 5Ms approach to evaluation and treatment, looking at how the interplay of mobility, frailty, medications, psychiatric and medical comorbidity conditions impact dementia care and how the presence of dementia affects the approach to other medical conditions. She works closely with the interdisciplinary team at the Alzheimer's Center to focus on patient and care partner priorities and goals of care. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or feel free to email us as the program goes on. voxpop@wamc.org is the email. And again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Rebecca Stetzer, great to see you. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
So just before we start, and we'll talk about the 5Ms briefly here. When you say geriatric, is there a specific age group? I mean, is there a, oh, you're X years old, you're geriatric now.
That seems to be evolving with time. You know, not too long ago, that would be 55 or 65. Now, partly just because of the aging population and the way we've changed aging, a lot of times it means 75 and older.
Really? So I have a ways to go.
You know, I really think that thinking about it in terms of frailty is more useful than age itself,
right?
Because I can have somebody who's 80, who's very robust, that really doesn't need a lot of a geriatrics approach. But I might have a 60-year-old who's quite frail that really could use it.
What are the 5Ms again?
You quiz me every time. Let's see how
I'm sorry,
doing.
But you know, it's in the lead and I forgot. And maybe I should see you. I don't know.
So, you know, certainly thinking about dementia, the first is going to be mentation. So thinking about cognitive function, memory, as well as any kind of mental illness, depression, that sort of thing. There's mobility, right?
Right.
Able to get around. Medications. So looking at making sure that the medications that you're on are still appropriate, that they're, you're not having side effects from them. That they don't need to be reduced. Looking at what matters most. So talking about goals of care, what is the goal of all of these medical interventions and are what we're doing helping you reach them, as well as thinking about like advanced care planning. And then multi-complexity, which is just sort of appreciating that it is complex when you have multiple different diagnoses, many medications.
A lot of doctors.
Yeah. Complicated social situation.
We're joined today by Dr. Rebecca Stetzer, a geriatrician with the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med. So you gave me some paperwork here, which, of course, I'm trying to figure out. But you gave a talk at the Guardian?
The Albany Guardian Society.
And this is interesting, this graph here. It seems to show that dementia is on the decline.
Yeah, so it's confusing, right, because the prevalence, right, so we have an increased number of people with dementia because the biggest risk factor is age.
Right, there are more old people.
There are more old people,
right.
So there are more people. But the incidence, so the percentage of the population that develops dementia has really dropped remarkably over the past 40 years.
Why?
A lot of it is that, you know, when you really think about dementia, a lot of time people jump to think about like Alzheimer's disease,
yeah.
Right? About a specific neurologic condition causing the memory loss. But what we know is that it's really a syndrome, a geriatric syndrome, where there are multiple different things influencing how we think and function. So you might have Alzheimer's disease, but if you also have high blood pressure and uncontrolled diabetes and you smoke and you have hearing loss, those things are all going to impact how you're thinking as well. So with all the things that we can do to treat all of these different diseases that we do so much better now, we've really decreased the number of people who are having that kind of memory problem.
Amazing. And why, again, is hearing loss key to this, or one of the keys to this?
Right. It's fascinating. It's something that there's been a lot more studies about recently. And a lot of right now, there's a lot of theories about it, right? We don't know exactly, but certainly part of it is if you can't hear something, you're certainly not going to remember it. And it's a lot harder to be engaged in conversations if you're not able to hear people. So even that starts to decrease the amount that you're thinking and you're engaged. And then there's also the brain needs to process anything that comes in. So if there's less information coming in, those parts of the brain aren't working as well. And we now have a couple of studies, one actual randomized controlled trial that showed that there were people who had mild memory problems and hearing loss. And some of them used hearing aids and some of them didn't. And the people who used hearing aids were less likely to progress to dementia.
So interesting. And this is the early stages of that research, or is this pretty well set?
Well, we just have that one randomized controlled trial and then other trials that are more observational. So it's still under investigation, but I'm convinced the moment I am eligible for hearing aids, I will definitely be getting them.
Oh, well, if you keep wearing these headphones, you will. Let me tell you something. Okay. Well, this is an interesting stat, and I'm trying to process it as we speak, but it's percentage of population with dementia by age in 1984, 2004, and 2024, and it's quite remarkable. The prevalence is much lower now than it was 20, 21 years ago for every age group. My question for you is, these are broken down age 65 to 69, and then in five-year segments all the way up to 95-plus.
Mm-hmm.
If you're 95 plus and you have dementia, didn't you have it when you were 90 and 85? I mean, do people get diagnosed with dementia at 95 plus?
They do. Yep. Absolutely.
Really?
And again, the biggest risk factor is age. Right. And so the older you get, the more likely you're to develop some memory problems. Right. And a lot of times, we all feel those memory changes as we get older. But it can be some of it can be part of normal aging. But it may be that it's not until you're much older that you're starting to have changes that are more significant than normal aging.
We're joined today by Dr. Rebecca Stetzer from the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med, a New York State designated center for excellence. The other piece of paper you gave me, population, and I don't know where this is from. I don't know if it's the same data that you had from this other graph that you showed me, but this is an interesting one. This is population attributable fraction of potentially modifiable risk factors for dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various things, depression, traumatic brain injury, smoking, hypertension. The very first one, early life, it says less education. Explain to me what education will do for your odds of getting dementia.
Yeah, sure. So this is from The Lancet, the 2024 report. And every few years they put together a report looking at those influencing factors. And so with, part of what we're looking at when we look at a dementia is that the delta, right, the change in how you're functioning. And so I think about the education as part of our cognitive reserve. Right. So sort of our wiggle room. And so the more that you know and the more that you spend time thinking, the better your brain is able to do that. So one, you can compensate some more and then you've got a little bit more room. Right. So if you have really a lot of intelligence and a lot of education, you can start to lose some of your memory and cognitive functioning. But it's not going to be
reserve.
Nearly as apparent.
Well, that's
right?
So funny. But
and it's funny. So for this chart, right, it really shows that as that's important for early life. Right. So one of those things that is so important to invest in our children and their education. But it continues to be important. Right. Continuing to learn and function in our middle age and even, as we get into older age, the more you spend time using your brain, the better it's going to work.
OK. And you probably can't answer this. Nobody can yet. but 30 years down the road, after this generation of all of us who have AI and have GPS maps and don't have to think much about anything, are we looking at a real epidemic, way worse than now?
So it's a great question. I guess what I think about with some of these things that we use is, what are they freeing our brain space up to think about? If I can use AI to help me with something and reduce some of my cognitive load, can I then use that, you know, that space I've got, that energy, to think about something else? So maybe we're just shifting how we're using our brains, not stopping using them. That's my hope, at least.
Well, that's a good hope. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Dr. Rebecca Stetzer joins us today. Geriatrics on the program. We'll be back. J.J. Johnson on WAMC Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Ray Graff with you. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Rebecca Stetzer joins us once a year or so from Albany Med, and here she is again. Let's begin in Gansevoort. And Martha, you're on.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I had a question. I have lost my sense of smell. It's very discouraging. I can't smell lilacs, lilies. And my mother had Alzheimer's and died at 80 from septicemia related to not being able to say that, you know, she was in pain. And I'm 79, and I had a bad head injury. I was unconscious for two days. And I've been a vegetarian since I was 14, and now I'm a vegan in the hope that I can avoid the fate of having Alzheimer's, which, having taken care of my mother along with my brother, who helped, it's a horrible fate to have. And I was just wondering, what are the chances that my loss of the sense of smell could be a sign of Alzheimer's?
That's not classically a symptom that we see with Alzheimer's disease, so I wouldn't put too much stock on that, for that alone. I would say if that's a change that you're having, I would make sure that you check it out with, one of your medical providers, just to make sure there's not something else going on.
What else could be going on?
Well, I don't really want to go into diagnosing phone, so I would check out with that. But I certainly understand your concerns in terms of having that family history. So really focusing on taking care of yourself. If you are a vegan, making sure that you're getting good nutrition, that you're getting enough protein, and you're getting enough vitamins, because vitamin deficiencies can be a part of the memory loss pattern. So focusing on that holistic care is going to be your best bet.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay. Well, thanks, Martha. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Maury in New Paltz. Hello, Maury in New Paltz.
Hi. It's funny that this is also about smell and Alzheimer's. Huh. I just came back from a trip to the UP in Michigan, and the gardener at one of the resorts told us that as long as we could still smell the lilacs, that we didn't have Alzheimer's. And then a couple days later, I got home and I felt an ask, basically, in an email from a national Alzheimer's research company that was asking me if I wanted to take a survey about loss of smell. And if I did, they'd send me, some sort of thing to make the smells and see if there was a problem.
All right, so we lost a couple of key words there. We lost a couple of key words. Maybe you're getting a call on another line, but I think we get the gist. Doctor.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, there are some other conditions that we can think about that might be associated with loss of smell. I mean, certainly most recently, even think about if there's been a history of COVID or something, which can have some cognitive implications. And so I would certainly pay attention to that. But again, that's not going to be one of the key hallmarks. I will say that the more that we learn about Alzheimer's and other dementias, the more that that we find out that we don't know. And so, you know, continuing to look at new things, and if there's some new research going out, it's always wonderful if we have a chance to take a look and see what other clues that we might get.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. You know, getting back quickly to this graph that shows potentially modifiable factors for dementia later in life, social isolation, dementia is a physical thing, right? In other words, there are physical changes to the plaque or whatever in your brain. Why would social isolation have anything to do with it?
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. Right?
I mean, even when you think about all of the changes that happen in the brain, there are physical changes, but the way they come out, right, are the way we think and we speak. And so the looking at loneliness, and we saw a lot of this, particularly during the pandemic, but that loneliness definitely increases risk for cognitive impairment. And some of it is, again, right, like the less you spend time interacting, and if you're already vulnerable, maybe having some cognitive impairment, and then you don't have interaction with people regularly, you're not actively listening, you're not having to come up with words, come up with conversations, all of those things are going to decrease your reserve, increase your vulnerability. But, you know, if you can think about spending a week alone and not having really any contact with people.
Sounds pretty good, to be honest.
But yes, it can have a profound impact. And that's definitely one of those areas that we're still learning about what's the exact mechanism.
Yeah.
But we know that that interaction and that mental engagement is key.
So based on these stats, and obviously things like smoking and hypertension, those are physical things. But could there be a regimen of exercises begun early, mental exercises, that would keep you, based on this 45% potentially modifiable, some of them, social isolation and things like that, depression, there are things that you could do perhaps to train your brain to be better in later life. Yes or no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there are a lot of studies looking out there, right, if this puzzle or that puzzle is going to do it. And it's not like there's any like magic program or magic puzzle that we found. The key is that engagement. So constantly learning. One of my favorite studies ever done was when I was about 10 years ago now, where the researchers taught people how to juggle. And they did MRIs at the beginning and the end of the study and measured the hippocampus, which is the memory center of the brain. And people actually had an increase in size of their hippocampus after learning how to juggle, right? And you think about that, you're learning something new. There's coordination. There's a physical aspect to it. So we know that learning and engaging is going to make a profound difference in our brains. So always learning is always helpful.
How's your juggling?
I probably should take the class.
Really? Okay,
yeah.
Maybe I should too. Let's go back to the phones. Robert is in Phoenicia. Robert, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Alzheimer's is a form of dementia, right?
Correct, yep.
And memory loss is a form of dementia?
I think memory loss is describing one of the symptoms of dementia.
Mm-hmm. One of the symptoms. What are the other forms or some other forms of dementia? Because it seems to me that Alzheimer's is going up, yet you're saying dementia is going down.
Prevalence thereof.
So what other forms of dementia are going down?
Yeah, so great question, and it gets really confusing, right? Because when we talk about dementia, that's actually a functional diagnosis, meaning that there's a change in memory and thinking significant enough to affect your ability to live day to day, right? So the point that you need some more help is when we would call it a dementia. So Alzheimer's is one of the neurodegenerative conditions that can cause it. Other common ones are things like Lewy body disease, vascular dementia, and frequently a mixture of multiple types. There are also some entities of dementia that, you know, causes that we don't fully understand. And actually, as we learn more about Alzheimer's disease and we're able to do some biologic diagnosis, we're learning some of the things we called Alzheimer's before aren't actually that pathology. So there are other types, other causes of dementia. And there's a good handful of other things that are more rare. But the whole point of this conversation, saying the incidence of dementia is going down, is that a lot of it has to do with your cognitive reserve, right? So how much material we're working with, if you will. So I might have somebody who has Alzheimer's disease, so they have changes in their brain that at some point will lead to dementia, we think. But if they have done everything else to keep their brain healthy, it might be that it doesn't present until they're 85, whereas if they had all of these other issues, it might have presented at 65, right? So when we're delaying, when we're saying that decreased incidence of dementia, it means that we're doing other things to take care of our brain so that people are able to continue to function.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. So there is this, as you put it, a mental reserve or cognitive reserve.
Mm-hmm.
My car has a 20-gallon gas tank. Mm-hmm. Is there, and that's, you can measure that. Is there a way to measure these reserves?
At this point, no. There are certainly different measures that certainly in research and some centers might do, looking at like the volume of the brain or that sort of thing. But, you know, the more I do this, there's the pictures that we take and you can see a brain that looks like there's a lot of atrophy, like a lot of shrinkage of the brain.
Yeah.
And then you meet the person who comes in and you just can't even believe that they're functioning so well.
Yeah.
Right. You would have no idea. So the problem is right now our measurements that we see on the imaging or even on the blood tests aren't necessarily going to translate to what we're seeing.
Yeah.
And that difference might be that cognitive reserve, right? That education and all the rest that we just can't measure at this point. We know it influences the way those neurons, the brain cells and the matter interact and that sophisticated thought process, but it's not something we can like put a number on at this point.
Dr. Rebecca Stetzer joins us today from Albany Med, geriatrics, and specifically dementia and Alzheimer's today, 800-348-2551. You know, you had mentioned some dementias turn out to not be Alzheimer's, and you're learning more and more about figuring what's what. I was always told way back when you can't really diagnose Alzheimer's until the person's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I see a commercial on TV the other day. And the woman is upset. The daughters are there. And she said, well, it was tough when I had the diagnosis. You can diagnose it now while someone's alive.
Yes, yes.
Blood test? How are you doing it?
Yeah, so it's amazing, actually, the changes in the last, even year that we've seen. So right now, the gold standard for living people, right, because we don't do brain biopsies on people,
right,
is there's a PET scan that measures the amount of amyloid plaque in your brain. And that amyloid plaque is one of the major parts of the development of Alzheimer's dementia.
Which came first, the dementia or the plaque?
The plaque.
So that's the cause.
So that's part of the cause. Yeah. So there's sort of this cascade of changes in the brain where there are different proteins that start to fold abnormally and then they injure neurons, they affect how they function and eventually kill them. And there's, it's a complicated process. We've been able to identify a couple of those proteins that really get elevated. Another one is the tau protein that gets elevated. And so we have now available for us to order are these PET scans that measure how much plaque is in the brain. And if it's elevated to a certain degree, we consider that positive.
But you can't really remove the plaque.
Well, we actually have two new medications out right now that do help remove the plaque.
And will removing the plaque reduce the symptoms?
So that's always what the goal would be, right? So our medications that we have, what our studies have shown is that they slow the progression. So they slow the rate of decline. They do a great job of actually removing those amyloid plaques. People don't get their functioning back, according to our studies. And we're just very newly using these medications, so we're really learning to see how they work. But what they do is, instead of progressing as rapidly as we would expect for Alzheimer's disease, it's less rapid.
Interesting. We're joined today by Dr. Rebecca Stetzer, a geriatrician with a special interest in dementia care at the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get to the emails in a moment, but let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
What's the best way to avoid nursing homes and psychotropic drugs?
Okay, so, you know, looking at nursing home care, I think about a couple of things, certainly in terms of memory and dementia. Part of it is going to be, you know, catching things early and having some good support, right, to have people help to fill in when there are those areas of help that come up, the areas of need. And then the other part is thinking about frailty, right? So we've been talking about memory changes in the brain, but it's the whole body that's affected as we age. And some of these even preventable factors that we talk about in terms of dementia and high blood pressure, diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol and smoking, those types of things are all going to increase your risk of heart disease and strokes. And then looking at ways to keep your body healthy, exercise, a healthy diet. We know a Mediterranean diet has great evidence for cardiovascular health and memory. And all of those things are going to help you be both more physically and more mentally robust.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot. Those populations that primarily subsist on the Mediterranean diet, do they have less incidence of dementia as a group?
Yeah. Yep.
Really?
So we've definitely, and it's, you know, looking at some of those studies, there's actually this great study that was done in Spain about 10 years ago, looking at a Mediterranean diet, and it was started for cardiovascular health. So they were really looking at the incidence of strokes and heart attacks and death from those. And people were randomized to either get a Mediterranean diet, which is counseling about that, plus either extra olive oil or extra mixed nuts, or they are counseled to go on a low-fat diet, right? Which, you know, until recently was what we thought was the best thing to do. They actually had to stop the study early because it was unethical to continue to tell people to take a low-fat diet because that Mediterranean diet was so effective in reducing heart attacks and strokes. And one cohort of the study, they really looked at the cognitive changes and really saw that the folks on the Mediterranean diet not only were less likely to progress, but some of them even had small amounts of cognitive improvement.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And they don't know why.
No, again, I think it's all linked to these same risk factors in terms of what we're looking at and some of the, you know, the contributing causes. A big part of the way our brain functions depends on the oxygen that we get to it and the blood flow, right? And one of the things that we will see in Alzheimer's or vascular dementia is that there's area of the brain that that there's damage to those small blood vessels, and those areas don't work as well. And so all of the things that we do to help support the health of our blood vessels is going to help our brain function better. Hmm. So I think it's all tied in to all of the rest of these cardiovascular risk factors.
We've talked a lot about risk factors, and we briefly touched upon amyloid plaques and the possibility of, you know, someday reducing the effects and turning the clock back. How much research is actually being done on curing it?
Well, it's a pretty active area of research, actually.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different studies going on and looking at different ways. You know, certainly with these new monoclonal antibodies for the amyloid plaques, we've learned that that's such a big component of it, right? We knew that that was part of the progression to Alzheimer's disease, and we've learned that removing those plaques helps slow it down, but it's not the whole story,
right?
And so there's so much going on trying to see what else can we do to help that.
I guess my question with that is how do you know that it's not the disease causing the plaques rather than the excess plaque buildup causing the disease?
So I guess I think the disease is sort of what we see, like what we experience. So if somebody comes in and they're having problems with short-term memory and problems with executive functioning, right? They're missing appointments. They're having trouble taking their medications. They're having emotional dysregulation, not acting like themselves. That's what I think of as the disease, right? So that's the dementia. That's the Alzheimer's disease. When we think about what's causing it, the pathophysiology, those are the changes in the body that cause those changes. So like if I think about if somebody has a heart attack, right, that's what they experience. But what causes it is the narrowing of those blood vessels in the heart that then doesn't allow blood flow to go to the heart tissue. So the amyloid plaque is the buildup of it is what contributes to the symptoms.
We're joined today by Dr. Rebecca Stetzer from Albany Med. Let's take a quick break here and then we'll check the email bag. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. How's about a little Dizzy Gillespie? Go ahead. What do you say, Zach? Do we let the bass solo go, or do we, I guess we'll fade it out. It's Dizzy Gillespie, The Mooch, a Duke Ellington tune here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Rebecca Stetzer joins us, and the email is voxpop@wamc.org. James writes in, geriatrics has been around for a long time. Many physicians today are involved in the care of older people with multiple issues, but now there's a new doc in town. How do you feel about patients allowing Dr. Google to join the patient care team? And how about Nurse YouTube? Are they friend or foe? And that's from James.
That's a great question. I guess my take on this is the more information and then the more thought process, the better, right? So if somebody has some concerns and they come into the room and said, hey, I looked this up, what do you think about that? That's just going to expand our conversation. So I never mind if people do their research. I think the problem is if you rely on that, right?
Yeah.
So if instead of going to the doctor, you look it up on Google, well, you know, Google isn't able to really appreciate the full person and the full complexity of it. So I don't think it would be a good replacement.
So you never get annoyed by a family member or a patient coming in saying, well, I know what this is because I saw it on the internet. That never bothers you. Is that the case? Is that what you're stating?
I feel like you're setting me up here.
All right, fine. You know what? This is not 60 minutes. We'll just move on. Mandy says, we have a family member diagnosed with Alzheimer's by your group. We're having a heck of a time getting their various physicians to share and review our loved one's current information. Getting physicians' appointments extremely difficult, and once at them, it's frustrating for each physician not to know what others have done or said. Okay, so in a general sense, and not just in Alzheimer's care, I have seen this firsthand that a loved one of mine had to go in for a procedure, and various doctors, you see a ton of doctors. Mm-hmm. Some of them have to be like apprised of the situation, and there's not a focus. You know what I mean?
I
think this is a valid comment from Mandy.
Absolutely. And it's extremely frustrating for everybody, right? I can't tell you how much time that we spend when somebody comes in looking across different platforms.
Yeah.
You know, there's more and more people using the electronic medical record, Epic, which can be really helpful. Every once in a while, somebody who saw a provider using that in a different state, and I'm able to get that information. But if they saw somebody down the street and they didn't use that, I can't get that information. So we do have some other resources that we use to look into it, but it takes extra effort. It takes specific papers being signed and time. So
yeah.
It's absolutely frustrating.
It's funny, though, in this age of computerization and centralization of data, that it couldn't all be accessed by every doc immediately.
It's insane. I agree completely. And it's really hard. So, I mean, as more and more people go to using Epic, it becomes easier and easier. And sometimes it's frustrating when small groups are sort of conglomerated into bigger groups.
Yeah.
But one of the things, like with Albany Med being connected with Glens Falls and Columba Memorial, it's a lot easier to see that data. And actually, if I have a patient who's admitted at Columba Memorial, I can actually read the notes of the doctors that saw them.
Oh, that's good.
And so stuff like that makes it a whole lot better. But I know it's hard. It's hard to get in. There's more patients than we have time to see them. And so the frustrations are there. So as we're working on the system, I would just say the more you can do to bring the information in so that, you know, bring in the lab work, bring in the scan report so that we can have as much information as possible and make that visit be as useful as possible.
You know, and this was not at Albany Met, but a loved one of mine had to go in for a procedure and we had to stay overnight. And the next door neighbor in her room was this old lady who was having a hip replacement, and she was 93. And I, you know, there's a curtain, so I didn't really see anything. But they had a person come in saying, I'm in charge of your, sort of a manager of your whole medical situation. I forget the term they use, hospitalist or something. I don't know what it was. But I thought it was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, why can't we get that too? I guess it's only for some people, but there you go. Louise in New Paltz says, I'm clumsy and I've hit my head really badly at times, including a car accident that I ended up with dyslexia from. How concerning are head injuries when it comes to Alzheimer's? It's Louise in New Paltz.
Yeah, so great question. I mean, certainly we know that head injury, traumatic brain injuries are going to increase the risk for developing dementia. And, you know, I would think about it, you know, in terms of Alzheimer's disease or any others, it just sort of is part of that contributing factor to some of the vulnerability of the brain.
Yeah.
So if you've had serious concussions or head injuries, then it does cause some disruptions of the nerves and increases the likelihood. I haven't seen anything that it increases the likelihood of one versus another type specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But it just sort of underlies the fact of doing what we can to avoid that, wearing our seatbelts, wearing helmets,
yeah.
You know, avoiding ladders when we can.
This is from Cheryl. In the early 2000s, my father had a series of mini strokes. He was in his mid-80s and had been functioning well. Shortly afterward, he started to demonstrate dementia-like behaviors. He was diagnosed with rapidly advancing Alzheimer's. His symptoms progressed quickly, almost daily, and approximately 9 months later, he passed away. Are there different types of Alzheimer's, or perhaps it was a different type of dementia? And that's from Cheryl.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. That's a good question. So that sounds like he had what I would consider a vascular dementia. So we used to call it multi-infarct, so meaning from multiple strokes, which sounds like is what he had experienced. Sometimes it can just be from sort of that slow progression of damage to blood vessel diseases. And it can be challenging, right, if we see somebody advancing that quickly to know exactly what's going on. It's not infrequent that somebody might have Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia. That mix is quite common. And if you've got both things going on, things are going to progress a lot more rapidly.
All right, one more email, and then we'll jump back to the phones. Dr. Rebecca Stetzer joins us from Albany Med. Arlene writes in, are there currently any studies in the area to determine one's risk for Alzheimer's disease?
Not sure of studies specifically there. There's an Alzheimer's Research Center in Albany run by Dr. Holub, and he does a lot of research. That's where I would look for that. You know, in terms of assessing an individual's risk, we do look at family history. There are some genetic tests. I don't know that I find them super informative because they can tell you have an increased risk, but you might have an increased risk and still not develop it. So sometimes it's just an exercise in anxiety.
Yeah.
That would be certainly something you could talk with your physician about.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go back to our phone lines, and we'll go to Leah, it is, in Accord. You're on.
Hi, thank you. Actually, this question is pertinent to what you were just discussing. I did one of those 23andMe genetic marker tests and got a result for slightly increased chance of late onset Alzheimer's. And I'm just wondering how to interpret that data and whether or not I should be, you know, how concerned I should be. But it sounds like maybe just from based on what you just said, it's not as concerning as it might be.
Yeah, it's really hard to say, right? Because we can have people that have genetic markers that indicate they're a very high risk for Alzheimer's disease. And, and you know, even if they've got some of the pathology, right? So those changes in those amyloid plaques, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to develop dementia. We also have lots of people that we test who have Alzheimer's disease, and they're in the lowest risk category. So those tells are only so helpful. So I would just sort of take that along with, you know, really trying to prioritize doing all those things to take care of yourself and your brain, making sure you're exercising, eating that Mediterranean diet, spending time with friends, using your brain, not smoking, wearing a helmet, right? All of those things.
Yes.
Getting your hearing checked, those types of things.
Right. Okay.
And one last question.
Sure.
Would it be smart in this instance to proactively take the amyloid plaque reduction medication?
So that's actually something that we're only able to give to people who have a diagnosis of early Alzheimer's disease, of Alzheimer's dementia. So that wouldn't be something that would be open to you.
Okay. Yes. Thanks for the call. What are the side effects of that? Are they, if they're benign, why doesn't everybody take them?
Well, it's they're not, and it's really this risk balance benefit. It's an IV infusion, so you have to come to one of the centers that give them every 2 or every 4 weeks, and the side effects can be bleeding on the brain or swelling on the brain, which can be quite serious. So
yeah.
Most people are asymptomatic, but not everybody, and so it's really a big decision if you want to take on that risk for the potential for a small amount of benefit.
All right, let's go to Rick in Newburgh. Rick, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to ask about any studies that have been done about the relationship between Alzheimer's / dementia and schizophrenia, and if schizophrenia is something that would predispose a person to Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, interesting question. If there are studies out there, they're not major studies. So that doesn't tend to be a big risk factor that we would see for that. There's another type of dementia frontotemporal that sometimes can be actually confused for schizophrenia. But in terms of having that as a younger person and developing it, that's not certainly a major risk factor. But there may be some studies out there that I'm not aware of.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate the call. It's 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Rebecca Stetzer today from Albany Med, and let's go to Copake and Franny. Hello, Franny. It's your turn.
Hi. Thank you. I'm just wondering about the over-the-counter medications that are advertised all the time on TV about increasing your memory. Make people seem to be taking them for years.
Yes, let's not say the name, but I know exactly what you're talking about. Let's not say the product name.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Unfortunately, they're not effective, and we actually have a really good study that was done a couple years ago looking at one of these commonly advertised medications that showed very definitively that there was no benefit from it. So I'm not even sure how they can ethically still advertise it. So and they're expensive, right? So I would say a much better use of your money is buying some fresh vegetables, going out on outings with friends that you enjoy, buying some good sneakers, going for a walk. So I would spend my money differently.
All right, fair enough. Franny.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. You know, it's a shame because in this culture, we love that quick fix.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be great if there was that one thing that made you just a little bit sharper.
Yes, indeed.
In my case, a lot sharper. But if you find something, let me know.
Okay.
Jim and Adams, you're on. Hello.
Hey, Ray.
Oh, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dr. Stetzer.
Hi.
Yay.
Yes, I wonder if you've heard, Doctor, about there was some research that was talked about on this radio station about maybe 2-3 years back. This was done at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, by she sounded like she was an Asian person, what type of accent she had.
All
and
right.
She was doing research.
Fine.
And using pulse beats of blue spectrum light, and then she had then done some small tests with that on people, and had some very positive results. And they were going to do a larger test with maybe, I think they said, mentioned something like 15 or 25 patients, and they had also added into their repertoire pulse beams of sound as well in the room that these people were being exposed to the pulse light. And they started using the pulse sounds as well.
So pulse light, what, directly on an open brain? Or what are you talking about here, Jim?
No. You sit in a room, and the light is pulsing in the room, and you have it, it goes into your eyes.
Huh.
And it passes through the nerve network into the brain.
Wow, fascinating.
There have been experiments that have been done and studies I heard several years back on a station of different types of pain were being treated with green spectrums of light and having great success with that. So,
There's definitely
the sun is
been
our
some
source
studies.
Of all life.
All right, let's Jim, let's see what Dr. Stetzer has to say.
So there's certainly been some, you know, a number of studies looking at the effect of light, and I would say even particularly on helping with some of the behaviors of dementia. When people get more advanced, they can have some behavioral changes, and we know that light is a big factor of it. We even talk about sundowning, right? So knowing that those behaviors tend to come on as the light changes at the end of the day. So there's definitely a component of that. I'm not familiar with the studies you're talking about at MIT, but it's exciting to think about some different ways that we can get at this.
All right. Well, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. What is the cutting edge of research in your estimation?
I have to say it's just really looking at all of the different factors, right? There are so many things that we know are influencing it. So
these are the 45% here of modifiable factors. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, and different ways of trying to interact with what's going on with the brain, right? We've looked at the amyloid plaques, you know, other studies trying to look at what is it matter which aspect of the plaque that we're getting at, or is it better if we're looking at a different protein, or even looking at the, like we know that there's hormonal links to it. So looking to see is there hormonal treatment or avenues that might be able to enhance some of that. So there's a lot of people, I mean, at Albany Med, they do a lot of research there. There's some really exciting research going on, just starting to look at these questions. Unfortunately, everything is still, I think, a little bit far off from a pill that we can take.
Really?
But I do think that as the next couple decades come around, we're going to have a lot more ideas of things we can do.
You know, we're almost out of time. We only have a minute or two here, but I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about sundown syndrome or sundowning a little more, because I've seen it firsthand, and it's spooky. And do you know why it happens?
I don't have a great reason for it. I do think that the light is a component. It does tend to change.
The changing of the light or the brightness of the light, in which case just everybody have the lights on.
Yeah, no, I think it's the changing of the light. It's interesting because even I found that people tend to have changes in behaviors overall at different times of the year. Right. So at this time of the year, when the days are longer and the sun's a little bit brighter, I tend to hear, oh, yeah, like our medications are working better or whatever. And then in the fall, it starts to be that start to get more phone calls about that. And so somehow our brains are so sensitive to what's going on, the light, that that's a component of it. With the sundowning, I think probably a component of it is just fatigue as well. It's at the end of the day and, you know, people tend to, we're all a little bit more tired at the end of the day and have a little bit less of that reserve, right, of that availability of what we're being able to think and do.
You know, Dr. Stetzer, you're a tremendous guest. And I'm, you know, I don't know what to ask most of the time. So what, in your 40 seconds left, what do you want to hit on that I have not asked about?
I guess I would say is really having people do everything they can to take care of themselves. One of the things that I see frequently is, you know, people who are overall doing pretty well and then they get very sick, end up in the hospital, then they have a change in their memory and they might do better, but they never quite recover from their baseline.
Yeah.
So anything that we can do to help keep ourselves healthy and out of the hospital, you know, getting your vaccines, making sure your pneumonia and your flu vaccines are up to date, making sure that you're getting to the doctor or treating your blood pressure. If you have hearing loss, go get it checked out. And if they offer you hearing aids, say yes and wear them every day.
You know, that strikes close to home. All right. So, Dr. Rebecca Stetzer, thanks for being here. We'll see you probably, what, next year?
Probably.
All right. Support comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live and age gracefully with dignity and respect. DaughtersofSarah.org. Thanks again to Dr. Rebecca Stetzer of Albany Med for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the tremendous calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened by Duncan Hines. Tomorrow, Betty Crocker will be screening the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the show, we head outdoors with wildlife biologist Jeremy Hurst and Josh Stiller. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you then.